He is here. Good afternoon, everyone. And welcome to this Wednesday, February 3rd meeting of the Oregon House Transportation and Economic Development Committee. So nice to have a room full of people. This doesn't happen to us very often in this committee, and we're delighted you're all here. We have two public hearings and four work sessions to do today, and there has been interest generated in a couple of topics today, which is why you are all here. So we're going to have a very full agenda. So we're going to go ahead and start right off with opening a public hearing on House Bill 4078. And I would look to Patrick to give us a brief update on what this is about. And then Representative Post is here. If you want to come up and tee this off, please. Welcome to our committee, Representative Post. It's very nice to have you here today.
Chair, House Bill 4078 creates a transit expansion fund, which provides for continuous appropriation of monies in the fund to the Department of Transportation, which is authorized to issue grants to entities that provide public transportation in rural communities, small urban communities, and certain large urban communities for the purpose of maintaining or expanding public transportation systems. This program would sunset on June 30th, 2036.
Good afternoon, Chair McEwen and members of the committee. Bill Post, I represent House District 25, which is Kaiser, St. Paul, and Newburgh. I'd like to say that the crowd is here because of me. These are all my former listeners of my radio show. I called them all last night and said, please come and attend. Thank you for coming. Appreciate it.
We're sure that that's the case.
Well, you said there's not usually this many people here. Seriously. I was part of a ballot measure here in the Salem-Kaiser area this past fall in the November election that proposed a payroll tax on businesses in the area, and in order to provide more funding for the bus service here in Salem-Kaiser. I was against the ballot measure. I voted no on it, and I was a part of the community that was on the no side because I felt that it further burdened the businesses in our area. And during that very, very contentious debate, I promised the folks in my town, Kaiser, that I would try to do something to stabilize funding for the bus service in the area, but that I would not add taxes. I would not add to anyone's tax burden. And I believe with the help of you folks here hearing this today that perhaps that we've done that with this bill. HB 4078 will help provide a stable, reasonable, and equitable source of funding for the state's small metro and rural transit providers. It provides funding that's matched with reasonable, fiscally sound accountability requirements. It allows providers access to federal funds that get left on the table by boosting local funds. And it will help ensure transit providers have the funds necessary to meet the growing and changing needs of their community, as well as a diverse group of users. I would lastly point out, and there are people that are way smarter than me that are going to come talk to you about this. I'm just here to introduce it to you. But I'd lastly like to point something out to this committee that I've only just become aware today of the fact that there were others before me that worked very hard on this issue that I was not aware of. And I really only found this out today. And so I want to say thank you to Representative Hack and to Representative McEwen and to Representative Buckley and others who led this discussion long before I was brought into it. And so it's not something completely new, and I certainly don't want to take credit for anything other than sitting here today and presenting it to you. But it's important to me, and it's important to the people of Kaiser. So I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Representative Post. Questions for the representative? Appreciate you being here. We have a number of people signed up to testify. I'll start with the first panel. If you would please come up. Sean Tate, Julie, and Al Densmore, please. Julie Brown. How are you all today?
I'm thank you.
Good. Welcome to our committee. It's nice to see you here.
Nice to be here.
In any order that you choose, please.
Thank you. I'll start us off. Good afternoon, everybody. Okay. Chair McEwen. Members of the committee, Sean Tate, here on behalf of the Salem Area Chamber of Commerce, and it's over 1,200 business members. Very happy to be here today. It's certainly my pleasure to speak with you about House Bill 4078, and I thank Representative Post for his support of this effort, the bill, as well as the folks that he mentioned that did a lot of work in the background prior to today. I'd like to start, if I may, with a quick overview of this topic from the point of view of the chamber. The Salem Chamber of Commerce supports public transportation and understands that effective transit systems benefit communities. As a community leader that cares about Salem and has a responsibility to its citizens and membership, the Chamber initiated this effort to seek a stable and equitable funding source to benefit Oregon's small urban, smaller metro, and rural public transportation providers. And talk a little bit now about why, because that's perhaps even more important. Why we're doing this. Simply put, many of Oregon's public transportation providers are facing funding challenges that can make it difficult to maintain just day-to-day operations, let alone improve service to meet the needs of a diverse and growing rider population. And as you know, providers receive federal grant funds that require matching local funds, and local funds are often difficult to come by and in some cases relatively unstable, with rules that specify that even your fare box dollars that you collect from riders cannot be used to match federal funds. Providers often end up leaving federal money on the table year after year, sometimes to the tune of hundreds of thousands of dollars. House Bill 4078 would create the Transit Expansion Fund, which would be a grant funding source that would potentially serve over 40 individual public transportation providers across Oregon. The purpose of the fund would be to provide outcome-based grants that match the federal transit grant money that providers receive. Expansion fund grants would be made available to qualified public transportation providers, and we'll get into the qualifications just a little bit down the road, to help them meet their individual operational challenges and improve service within their communities. House Bill 4078 would help providers with many of the same operational challenges and improvement opportunities as Oregon's largest providers. To be clear, this grant program is not a blank check without any accountability for use of the money. On the contrary, House Bill 4078 is written to create accountability through its internal processes. As an example, the bill would require applicants to submit a transportation development plan that outlines how the grant would be used to maintain or improve service in their service area. Additionally, the plan must set forth some objective performance measures to be approved by the Department of Transportation against which the success of the plan would be measured. Additionally, all providers that receive grant funds would be required to submit a report every biennium to the Department of Transportation as part of the reapplication process that describes the use of the funds and demonstrates satisfactory implementation as it relates to the established performance measures. With that brief 30,000-foot overview, I'd like to introduce my friend and colleague to my right, Julie Brown. Julie is Executive Director of the Rogue Valley Transportation District. She serves as President of the Oregon Transit Association and is also Chair of the Oregon Public Transit Advisory Committee. Julie's going to speak to the bill, providing the perspective of a provider and perhaps some more technical aspects of transit funding.
So Chair McEwen and members, thank you again for allowing us to come today. For the record, my name is Julie Brown. I'm the General Manager of Rogue Valley Transportation District. As Sean alluded, I'm going to be wearing about three different hats, and I will kind of indicate who I'm representing when I'm talking about the issues. But first of all, I'd like to talk as the Chair of the Public Transit Advisory Committee. This committee is a committee that represents transit providers to the Oregon Transit Commission. One of the things that we've heard for many, many years is the struggles that small rural communities have and small urban communities have to be able to either meet their federal obligations by matching funds or just trying to find some kind of local funding. And because we're so unique in the state of Oregon on our formation of what our transportation systems look like, some of us are municipalities, some are counties. We have council of governments who provide services. We have special districts that do. Because of that, all of us have different funding mechanisms that come from the local area. In my area, now I'm putting on my RVTD hat, we actually have a property tax that levies 17 cents per thousand. It brings in about $2.4 million a year, and it matches our federal funds. In this last year, we had to leave about $300,000 on the table. Now, this money does not go away. It's obligated by the federal government. But it means that we have to be creative and find a local way of matching those dollars. We do things like sell advertising and other various ways of bringing in that revenue. And as you know, coming out of recession, it's hard to sell some of that advertising. But with that said, that's just one example. In the Corvallis area, which is another small urban area, they actually have a utility bill that they bill each individual property for utilities, and they have this transportation fund. That is how they match their federal funds. Now, when we get into Frontier Oregon, as they refer to themselves, over in Eastern Oregon, you know, they struggle, but they're able to do it. I think that one of the things that really hit me really hard this last year was when a Connect Oregon application came through from Eastern Oregon for two different facilities, and they weren't asking for a lot of money, under $50,000, and they didn't have the match. We had to turn them down. This is just examples, and that would have given them a place to wait indoors for a bus at their system. So it's things like that that we struggle with, and I think that this bill really brings equality across the state and really talks to those things. What we would like to see is dial-a-ride systems in Eastern Oregon actually be able to improve into a fixed route system at some point. Some of them have them, but they're always on the cusp of losing them because of the funding. Now I'm going to put on my hat for the OTA and talk about all of us in general. And I think that what this brings to us is the opportunity to provide a level of service that brings value to our communities. I'm talking about support of transportation across the state that gives a solid foundation to encourage communities to expand their systems by getting local people to see the opportunity. And so we're not asking that we supplant any local dollars. It's actually lifting up our systems and allowing the local dollar to go further. And then lastly, I want to put my hat on for RVTD and talk about our system, which is a small urban system, Southern Oregon. We went out for a ballot measure about a year and a half ago in November, and unfortunately, we were not successful at the ballot. But that didn't deter us from trying again. We are going to go out again in May and ask again to our community. What we are seeing in our community is that there is this need to grow into some of the urban growth boundaries and provide a level of service that our cities, our municipalities expect from us, and yet we have no funds available to expand. And so this is an opportunity for us to do this. And I want to connect this a little bit for you. Rogue Community College received some land outside in the industrial park area of Southern Oregon. They built a community college, and they just recently got a grant for $14 million from the federal government. It's great because it actually brings in low-income people to actually get technical, get assistance to become technical positions in our medical field. There is no transportation out there. I have no money available to actually give them a route. This is one of the areas where we can connect education, and it's really key because the other thing that we've talked to is our high schools and our superintendent from our high school, our largest high school, talking about being able to have accelerated programs for juniors and seniors to be able to go and start their career in their education, and yet there's no way to get them there. So for us, this is very important, as it is to all our Oregonians. I just want to thank you again for giving me this opportunity to share this.
Thank you very much.
My name is Al Densmore. I also am employed by John Watt Associates, and I think the only thing I would add at this point is that I'm here to answer questions. As Sean put it, that if someone wanted to ask why state funds should be spent on this, because anticipating the elephant in the room as to where funds might come from or why this ask. And I guess I look at it this way. We felt this effort needs to accomplish three things. We need to first establish and shine a light on the need for rural systems and small urban systems across the state to be in the conversation about public transportation, because it's every bit as much an issue in the small areas of the state as it is in the urban areas. It's the same need. It's the same need in terms of delivering those services. Just a scale difference is all that's different. And the second thing we're trying to accomplish is this solution that we're proposing, is it the right solution, or is it get us in the right direction? Because if we don't have the answers to those two first questions first, then the third question of where the funds come from is irrelevant. And I guess what I would say about the funding is that the state of Oregon does expend a large amount of money in transporting people for different needs in health and education, and also the emerging area of the environment, trying to encourage people to use more public transportation to reduce vehicle miles traveled, to reduce greenhouse gases. So if we're trying already and expending funds in that general area anyway, doesn't it make sense to go the last mile, make the last connection, and make all these systems work together effectively? And we stand ready. If the answers to those first two questions are yes, then we stand ready to work with those of you in the legislature and Ways and Means and whoever you would so direct to try to help us try to understand how that solution is to be crafted. But Chair McCune and members of the committee, we appreciate your time, and we think that the stories that you will hear are compelling.
Thank you for your testimony, and thank you three for being here today. I'd like to ask my colleagues if they have any questions for this panel. Vice Chair Davis.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you very much for being here and everybody for coming. I have a question regarding Section 2 of the bill and who eligible providers are. If we talk about how the determination was made both for Section 1BA for populations of 200,000 or less, and then why the carve-out of population centers of 200,000 or more that are not currently levying a payroll tax.
Yeah. Right. So would you ask your first question one more time so I can make sure I get it correct?
Sure. Thanks. The first question is why the demarcation of 200,000 or less? How was that number selected? For me, more importantly, then, because I think that's dealing with what's rural and what's not, but I'll let you answer that and I have a follow-up.
Okay. Originally, how Chair McCune, Vice Chair Davis, originally how we set out to, or what we set out to address, frankly, were the transportation providers that are not often talked about when it comes to the discussion about funding transit. For no exclusionary reason of leaving out TriMet or LTD. TriMet and LTD, the two large providers, have traditionally more stable funding sources that are more at the ready than these other communities have, and so that's why we drew that line to include this effectively Salem-Kaiser Transit and smaller communities. Does that answer your question?
Follow up.
Yes.
I think we're getting to the second question, which is why the inclusion of large communities, 200,000 or more, that are not currently levying a payroll tax. But I'm trying to wrap my head around why that exception would be allowed if we're trying to help small transit providers.
Why, Chair McHugh and Representative Davis, why Salem would be allowed as an exception?
Well, I don't know if you're using Salem. I don't know if Salem is the only one that would qualify under the exception. Right. 2B, but if that's the case, then I guess we're at the nut of it.
Okay. Okay. I'm not sure that I have a great answer to your question, but I'll tell you a little bit about let me find it here in my notes. I'm sorry. Right. These groups are presently not levying a payroll tax. And some of the lessons learned from those that are levying a payroll tax, and you know, Salem tried to do this during their ballot initiative.
Right.
Payroll taxes struggle through downturns in the economy; they're not always stable, and we saw Salem struggle with that funding.
Mm-hmm.
which, you know, clearly the community said that's not something that we want to do, yet Salem still has the same needs in terms of addressing deficiencies or gaps in their service. Mm-hmm. And so that's, again, you know, if there's a better answer, I'm not sure what it is. But that's where we drew the line. Julie, if you have something to add.
Ms. Brown.
Pushed him out of the chair.
Enlighten us.
Chair McKeown and Vice Chair Davis. I think I can answer this a little bit better. So in our formations, the federal government actually figures out the formation. So there's a formation of over 200,000 becomes a mass transit district.
Right.
Under 200,000 becomes a small urban district. And then under that is also the 5311 small rural. So mm-hmm. they have established three different levels of funding. The 5311 is for your small rural agencies. And in that black packet, you'll see this. And this is the list of all of the 5311 and 5307 recipients. And so that is why this language is crafted that way, was to include Salem-Keizer, because they do not have the payroll tax. Does that make sense?
No.
Okay. I'm sorry.
I know they're not, I know they're included because they don't include the payroll tax. Why would they be in here? Because they strike me as a rather large transit district.
They are a rather large transit district. They are a mass transit over 200,000. But when you don't have your local area support that idea of a payroll tax, they're kind of left out there where they're just struggling. They're cutting services. And I know that my colleague, Alan Pollack, the general manager, is going to speak to you about this. But I'm going to leave this up to him to sell why he should be in the package. But to me, it makes sense. I think that one of the things that, as a transit agency, that we struggle with is it's hard to sell to your local people a service for them to envision what it would look like. Until they see it, it's hard for them to continue supporting it. And I think that this is what we're trying to do, is lift us to a level to where they see the value of it in their community.
Follow.
Yes.
And I think the question is, I mean, you said it, not me, if there isn't support, and I'm not going to be one to stand here and defend the payroll tax, but if there's not support from the local constituency, then what interest does the state have in providing that?
You want me to answer that?
Anybody at a later date?
Anyone who's willing to try.
Willing to try.
Well, I guess I would refer to the remarks I made earlier. And essentially, one of the things that I was asked to do as a consultant to the Rogue Valley Transportation District was to engage our community and try to talk with business and community leaders and understand, number one, if someone has an automobile and isn't currently using public transportation, why should they be motivated to support it? And we really haven't had that discussion deeply enough, visibly enough, in a lot of communities across the state, so that whether you're talking about a payroll tax or an increase in the property tax, that it would be successful. And I think we've done a good job in the last several months beginning to engage the community around that question, and we'll find that there are several good reasons to say yes to that question. I have a good Rotarian friend that I saw at a meeting recently, and he said, you know, Al, I didn't realize the need for public transportation until my eye doctor said, I'm sorry, Carl, you can't drive anymore. Mm-hmm. And he still has to get to work. We have to have the capacity as a vibrant community to have these resources available. So that would be my take.
I very much appreciate the three of you coming and helping. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Lively, please
jump
in here.
Chair. I just have just one clarification. So your vote in Rogue Valley was for an increase in the property tax?
Yes.
Okay. And I don't know if you can answer this, but I'd like some clarification on what the restrictions is by the state of who can or cannot levy a payroll tax, regardless of how it has to be approved. Mm. I'm not unclear whether the size or something that also, I know there's restrictions by the state, but I'd like to understand what those restrictions are.
Chair McKeown and Representative Lively.
The restrictions are actually in the formation of the district. Okay. So it isn't open necessarily. I guess to give you an example, the Sandy municipality actually has a payroll tax that they implemented. But for mass transit and transportation districts, we actually have it in our formation that we can go out for the vote of the people. It gives us the right to it.
Mm-hmm. But you still, excuse me, but that you could go out just like Salem did and ask for a payroll tax versus the property tax?
Correct.
Okay, thank you. I just needed to. Okay. Thank you.
Yes, Representative Hack. Thank you, Chair. Thank you for coming, and thank you for presenting this. Appreciate it very much. I think that we might need a little bit of clarification, too, on the without and with free water Rainier. That hasn't been addressed, and I think that there may be some question down the line about that, so now might be a good time to do that. And then maybe a little clarification in addition to the actual funding piece, because when you look at the information you provided to us with the legislative yearly match of $21 million, some clarification possibly on, is there enough funds generated by the interest that you're talking about in the Treasury piece? How is that going to come to play? I think it'd be good for people to really understand, for us to understand how that's going to work.
Okay, Chair McEwen and Representative Hack. The Milton Free Water and the Longview, Washington issue. The reason I put that on there is presently they receive, the state receives money from the federal government for them, and they're for the communities of Milton Free Water and Rainier. And I threw that in there because I'm not sure what to do with it. I don't know. There hasn't been much discussion, and I think that maybe Hal Gard, when he gets up here from the Oregon Department of Transportation, may be able to talk a little bit more about it. But we have been funding them in the state through the federal, you know, the pass-through. So that is why they're on the list, because the state does receive money for them. And I'll let my colleague Al Dinsmore speak to...
Oh. Chair McEwen and Representative Hack, could you frame that question? Just, I'm a little uncertain by what you meant by Treasury. Or
well, you had mentioned before that you hadn't, you didn't know where the funding was going to come from. You hadn't determined that yet, or in your previous testimony. But the bill talks a little differently than that. It says that it'll be established through the state treasury, separate and distinct from the general fund. So can you talk a little bit about how you're going to do that? And I just think it's some clarification on, it's still a general fund ask, correct?
But I think I'd like to defer that to Sean, because he was involved in the drafting of the measure.
And the grant piece of, it's not a competitive, this is, everybody's going to qualify.
Yeah. Right. Thank you for the question, Chair McEwen, Representative Hack. It is a general fund ask at this point, but it's an unspecific ask, and that's, as my colleague Mr. Densmore alluded to earlier, that's the elephant in the room in terms of, you know, the amount of money and where does the money come from. And as he also alluded to, we have some ideas, and we're very hopeful that we'll be able to carry those forward into conversations with Ways and Means. With regard, Representative Hack, to your question about everybody being eligible for a grant, everybody would certainly be eligible to apply for a grant. However, because this would be an outcome-based grant system as part of the accountability side of this bill, there are certain things that I think are going to get spelled out perhaps better and more specifically in rulemaking. But they're going to be required to produce the public transportation plan that outlines what they're going to do with it, what the benefit to the community is, and then once again, how their implementation of their plan using the grant funds would be measured in terms of success. Will everybody qualify? Remains to be seen. Everybody certainly has the opportunity to apply, and provided their grant application would meet with the standards, you know, not yet set forth by the Department of Transportation.
That's what I wanted. Thank you.
If just that answers your question.
Yes. Right. Thank you.
Right.
Just that
right.
They'll qualify, but right. There's going to be some sideboards to this, and it's not going to be just.
Right.
So thank you.
Right. Certainly.
Any further questions?
evening, and thank you so much for being here this afternoon. We're delighted to have you on our committee. Next, I would like to call up, I may get this wrong, Mr. Hassenflug. Am I close? Mr. Pollack and Ms. Corin or Coran? Lydia? Great. Welcome to our committee. Thank you for being here this afternoon.
Madam Chair, excellent pronunciation.
Every now and then a blind squirrel gets in.
It's easier in English. It means hates plowing.
Thank you.
I forgot I had notes. Madam Chair, representative and members of the committee, my name is Roger Hassenflug. I'm the immediate past executive director of an organization called Living Opportunities. We operate in Southern Oregon and serving people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, basically helping people work for the same companies everybody else wants to work for, live in the same neighborhoods we'd all want to live in, and just generally engage in our communities the same way everybody else would. Currently, I'm serving as the lead consultant for that organization, having semi-retired, for what's called an Employment First Transformation Grant. There are 25 of those grants let by the state. And the purpose of those grants is to help organizations like Living Opportunities, and let me say that each one of you has organizations like Living Opportunities in all of your districts, to help organizations that applied for those grants transform their operations from segregated employment to integrated competitive employment in local businesses in their communities. The recent settlement of a class action suit in the state of Oregon, Lane versus Brown, commits the state to creating that type of employment statewide for thousands of Oregonians over the next 10 years. So essentially what I'm working on is helping organizations meet the commitment in that settlement. Living Opportunities is one of two training and technical assistance providers in the state of Oregon. And together we're working with 25 organizations. There are many more organizations like ours in the state, but we're working with 25 of them who applied for these grants to achieve those outcomes. And in fact, Madam Chairman, we're working with Star of Hope. I believe that's from your district. Lack of transportation is a significant barrier to this population. I'll give you an example. Living Up worked with about 340 people last year. Two of them had driver's licenses. So we're talking about people that are very reliant on fixed transportation systems and paratransit systems to get pretty much anywhere in their community, but in this case especially to work. I can also tell you that in working with those 25 organizations around the state, that one of the very top issues that they're concerned about is their public transportation systems in their community. And we're talking about organizations that are literally all over the state, including in very rural areas. Some of them have dial-a-ride systems, paratransit systems. Many of them don't have fixed route systems currently at all. Organizations like the ones we're working with are generally eligible for what's called special transportation funds or STF funds. Part of the problem with those funds is that their availability is uncertain from one year to the next. Our hope with this bill is that it will increase or make certain the availability of those funds for organizations so that they can have an opportunity to advocate with their local transit districts to be able to help people get to work.
Thank you.
Extending service areas, extending fixed routes times, and so forth. So with that, I would close.
Thank you. I will note we have a number of people signed up on the bill that's going to follow this, and we still have a number of people to testify on this, so I'm going to ask you to condense your testimony a little bit so we can make sure everybody has a chance to speak.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair McCune, members of the committee. I'm Alan Pollack, the general manager for Salem-Keizer Transits. Thank you for allowing me to support or testify in support of HB 4078. There should also be a letter of support in your packets. Mm-hmm. Just by quick background, Salem Kaiser Transit is the service provider for the urban growth boundary within Salem and Kaiser. We do that through the chariot service as well as the cherry lift paratransit service. But we also operate regional service to Wilsonville and Grand Ronde and rural service in rural Marion and Polk counties. And you've probably seen those buses are the CARTS system, a separately run system that we administrate. We provide, of all those services, about 3.4 million rides per year. So from a funding perspective, you know, the district's local operations, as you've heard, is the property tax. Mm-hmm. And of the three mass transit districts, TriMet, Lane, and us, their payroll tax were property tax. So there's some caution when we kind of get thrown into that big group. We may, by population, be a big agency, but by funding, we operate and run more like a smaller rural transit through a local property tax instead of a payroll tax. Another way to look at it, because we get compared very often to Lane Transit District, because of the size of our service areas are very similar in population. And they do a great job down there, and they say, well, how can they do that and you can't even provide weekend service? Well, when you look at the local funding commitment, for every dollar we bring in, they bring in three. So if we had that, we could do some great things too. We have been responsible financial stewards with the money that we do bring in. However, we have a huge demand for service, especially for Saturday and weekend service, with no new dedicated funding on the horizon. You're aware of the ballot measure that happened in November that we were unsuccessful in as we're seeking to increase that local funding. We believe we're the largest urban center in the Pacific Northwest without weekend service. If successful, HB 4078 will allow us to enhance the service that the community is asking for by providing weekend service and even later evening service. Right now, we do a pretty good job if you're an 8-to-5 commuter, but this community has a large service sector population who work non-traditional hours and weekends. And so we could get them to work on the weekdays, but they can't get home, and then they're on their own on the weekends. Even for your community college students, we can't get them to their night classes. We can get them there, but not home. So I'd ask for support for those agencies who do not derive a payroll tax by supporting HB 4078. Thank you for allowing me to testify.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair McCune and members of the committee. My name is Lydia Corin, and I'm here on behalf of Ride Connection. We're a nonprofit serving Clackamas, Multnomah, and Washington counties. We serve people with disabilities and older adults, as well as low-income job seekers and rural general public. And I'm here to say that we help people. I have a couple stories from our riders. We help people like Amina, who lives in Banks. And when she first moved out there, she couldn't find a job there for her in Banks. So she uses the Ride Connection community bus to get herself to the Hillsborough Transit Center, where she ended up finding a job in Beaverton. So she is able to connect on and access jobs and connect with the urban transit system TriMet there. We have people like Jesse, who lives in Forest Grove, who, upon moving there a few years ago, was really not at all active in her community, and other than a few rides here and there from her family, could not get around. So right now she uses GroveLink, and as soon as she started using it, she realized how awesome it was and started getting around her community. People like Amina and Jesse have no other options if our services don't exist. Ride Connection also works with The Wave, based in Tillamook, so we're constantly working on ways to leverage our federal funding. So The Wave, instead of duplicating the service it does, we worked with them so that they made an extra stop in Banks to transfer people all the way into Portland. So even though we're doing everything we can to leverage the money we get, it's still not enough. You know, we provide about 500,000 rides a year, and we still have to turn down about 20% of those requests. And we think that that's just really too bad. I mean, we really want to make sure that the people of our communities are able to access health care, jobs, education, and HB 4078 will go a long way to do that for us.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Questions for this panel? Representative Hack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. More of a comment, I guess. I wanted to thank you, Alan, for your testimony and for being here and for being supportive. And I think it's good for you to clarify the difference between Salem and that it is large. It's deceiving. But I think that that was good for clarification for us to understand the difference in the funding mechanisms, and that's what makes transit so interesting and unique, and I'm glad that we're bringing this to the forefront. And I know the need for Saturday service in Salem, and I'm a little biased because it's my district, so I've signed on the bill and I'm supportive, but I just wanted to say thank you for coming and thank you for what you had to say.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you all for your testimony. Question about Ride Connections. How are you funded? What's the portfolio look like for how you operate?
Well, we receive federal and state grants, and we also receive private support. We receive donations and corporate sponsorships as well, private grants as well.
What's the mix, do you know?
Our mix is, percentage-wise, we're about 97% state and federal funded.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Appreciate it. Next, I'd like to call up, I think we'll go ahead with the next panel. Mr. Gard, we're going to have on the phone Frank Thomas and Aaron, I'm not... Spreadsboro.
Frank Thomas.
Am I close?
We're on a roll with me.
Whoa, I did my best. And while we're getting this gentleman on the phone, Mr. Gard, please go ahead and proceed.
As quickly as I possibly can, yes.
Actually, Patrick would like us to wait a minute.
Union County Public Transit.
Had to add an extension, sorry.
Public Transit, this is Frank.
Hi, Frank. This is Patrick Brennan, committee staff for the House Transportation Committee at the Oregon Legislature. You're live in the committee. I'll turn it over to my chair.
Yes, sir.
Gentlemen,
you.
Do you mind if I go ahead and proceed? Mr. Thomas, you're on the phone with a room full of people who are very interested in this topic. Our committee stands at ready for your testimony, so please begin when you're ready.
Thank you. Thank you. Karen McEwen, representative members of the committee. My name is Frank Thomas, and I work for Northeast Oregon Public Transit, serving Baker, Union, and Willamette counties. We'd like to thank you for the opportunity to present. If you take nothing else away from our testimony, we'd like you to know that basic public transit is vital to Oregon's rural communities. In our region, we are the critical infrastructure that connects students to Eastern Oregon University and Blue Mountain Community College, labor to jobs, which is a really sore subject for some of my light industry employers right now, elders to medical care and prescriptions, low-income families to community services, a growing population of veterans to regional private providers of earned benefits, and customers to businesses. Before I talk much about how House Bill 4078 would be a potential source of matching funds, I'd like to take a brief moment and give you some context of the importance of federal and state mobility investments in our region. We're probably unique in the state of Oregon because by the time demand for public transit has grown to the point that it requires fixed routes, full-scale ADA paratransit, intercity connections between communities, it's typically offered by a city, county, or a taxing district. It's almost never the domain of a private nonprofit with, you know, variable budgets and competing priorities. In Northeast Oregon, our costs are actually higher because it's frequently a long ways between population centers, and during the winter, it's an exceptionally long way. In the case of our Willamette County service, we're the only public provider connecting otherwise isolated residents to the rest of the state's mobility infrastructure. In our agency, Section 5311 and the local match that leverages it combine to constitute 40% of our funding. In one of our counties, it's almost half. Generating eligible local resources to match the federal investment is a perennial challenge, and our primary sources are Oregon Special Transportation Formula Funds. By the way, thank you for your national leadership on that one. Student fees from Eastern Oregon University, and the income that we can derive from incidental Medicaid contract deliveries. All of those sources are unpredictable. So in a moment, I'm going to close by sharing with you some exciting opportunities that we can derive from our program of projects. But before I do, I'd like to emphasize that one of the most important aspects of House Bill 4078 is the stability and the certainty that it will create for our mutual constituents in rural communities. Northeast Oregon Public Transit is really blessed by the presence of a highly engaged set of advisory councils and a lot of robust planning procedures. So we're accustomed to dealing with resource scarcity, and our projects have been designed to be scalable, phased in over time, and ordered by the priority of the jurisdictions they serve. Here's what House Bill 4078 would mean to us. First of all, it would not supplant any of the existing sources of local public transit funding. In Baker County, it would increase fixed route frequency during peak demand hours. Plus, it would give us a planning and operations project opportunity to serve two isolated bedroom communities that are along corridors that could make nice intercity hub connections to other surrounding rural counties. It would increase Saturday fixed route and an ADA paratransit service in Baker County, and it would expand morning and evening service for fixed route and paratransit in Baker City. In Union County, it would increase morning and evening services for fixed route and paratransit. It would add fixed route frequency during peak demand. It would produce some demand response services on Sunday, and we would reduce bus fares by 50%, which would set that back to approximately 2005 levels. In Wallowa County, it would triple their days of intercity service to LeGrand. It would add an extra day of their Dial-A-Ride shopping bus, two more months of their summer shuttle fixed route every year. It would begin in April rather than in June. And they would set their fixed routes, or their, I'm sorry, their bus fares back to the 2005 levels, decreasing by almost 50%. So these projects could all be live within a couple of months of notification. We just have to perform our required public processes and hire and train new staff, and some of those processes could probably be run concurrently. If launched in full force all at once, the first year volume growth is estimated at 39% in Baker County, 35% in Wallowa County, and 25% in Union County, where utilization is already starting out a little bit higher.
Okay.
There's no reason for us to doubt that the growth would continue and probably compound, but this is an unprecedented opportunity in the 47-year history of our agency, so going out more than a year or so would be purely speculation at this point. But the beneficiaries of this support line up across the board. In Union and Baker and Wallowa counties, you're looking at the graying of these communities, meaning elders would probably disproportionately benefit. And in Union County, Eastern Oregon University kind of skews our results a little younger.
Mm-hmm.
In all three counties, people with disabilities are the fastest growing passenger demographic we serve, and that would likely continue to be so with expanded access opportunities. In conclusion, I'm in my 20th year in this industry, and I've never been in a better position to make so many quality of life contributions to the rural communities we serve. We're really excited about showing you some meaningful return on public mobility that your intentional modest investments can make. Chairman McHugh, representatives of the members of the committee, I can't thank you enough for this opportunity to present. I humbly ask for your support of this bill, and I will happily attempt to answer any questions you may have.
Well, Mr. Thomas, thank you so much for your testimony, for joining us from such a distance. I do have one question from Representative McLean.
The question I have, sir, was as you described the future possibilities, that would be basically what your grant would be as you follow through the public process for this grant type of program?
Chairman McKeown, Representative McLean, yes, that is correct.
Okay.
The existing services we have would be preserved, and the resources freed up, of local resources that would have gone to match, freed up by House Bill 4078, would allow all of those other expansions presently on our planning documents to take place.
All right, sir. Thank you so much. We have a list of folks who want to testify, so unless you have anything else very brief to add, I think we'll excuse you. You're welcome to stay on the line and listen to the rest of the testimony if you like, but I think we'll move on, sir.
Thank you so much. I will watch you on the Internet.
Thank All right. You. Thank you so much. Mr. Garden, as
Chair
brief
McKeown,
as
can
possible.
I go last?
Certainly. Yes.
Chair McKeown and committee members, thank you. My name is Andrew Spreadborough. I'm the executive director of Central Oregon Intergovernmental Council, or Regional Council of Governments in Central Oregon, and we operate the Cascades East Transit System. And before I talk about the specific reasons why we support House Bill 4078, I wanted to give you a little bit of background on our system. I think we've heard that there are a number of unique systems and models in terms of delivering public transportation. There's certainly a lot of different funding approaches. And I think we characterize some of the unique approaches to providing public transportation. We are the Cascades East Transit. It's a public transit system integrating the rural Central Oregon communities with the Bend Urban System. We operate the Bend Urban System and provide service throughout the region, including local service in Lapine, Madras, Prineville, Redmond, Sisters, and we operate a community connector shuttle link linking all of those communities with public transportation services. As a council of governments, the governance of the system rests with the cities and counties. We're not an independent district, so local governments manage and run the system collectively. And according to the National Transit Database, since we really launched this integrated system in 2010, we're the sixth largest transit provider in Oregon in terms of rides and budget. We serve the fourth largest population area, over 200,000, which may have had something to do with the wording in the House bill. And we also have an immense service territory. We operate 100 miles north to south, 50 miles east to west. We have some very unique challenges in terms of serving the region. This integrated rural and urban model really works for Central Oregon. It's a kind of a made in Central Oregon solution. We recognize that the region operates as an integrated economic unit. We share workforce. We share amenities. There's a lot of intra-region travel between communities. A lot of our services are regional in nature. Medical services are centralized, and education as well. We do not have a dedicated formal local funding source approved at this point. So we are heavily reliant on local general fund, city and county appropriations. All of our cities and counties contribute into the system. We also have formal partnerships with some of the major institutions. St. Charles Health System is a investor in the transit system, Central Oregon Community College, OSU Cascades, and others. So we've really braided together a lot of funding sources. About 40% of our budget's federal. The rest is local with a little bit of state. In terms of why we support it, transit is a important solution to a number of regional challenges we're facing right now. We have urban pressures in the city of Bend. We have some growth pressures in certain parts of town. We have a major university moving in. We have congestion issues emerging. Bend is one of the fastest growing communities, and it's only going to exacerbate over time. And transit is a solution to some of those growth pressures. We recognize that. In the rural system, it's not about congestion, it's about access. And really, our riders are accessing work, they're accessing healthcare, education, job training, and employers are accessing a workforce. We have a very significant housing job imbalance in our region. I think it's been well documented, and transit is part of the solution to making sure our residents have access to healthcare and education and jobs, really.
Mr. Spreadwell, I hate to interrupt you, but we're going to get very time constrained if we don't start to speed this up a little bit. So
okay.
Could you wrap up and move
I will.
On?
I will
you.
Say two more things.
Thank you.
One being that stability in transit funding is very important to us. Right now, we have a very volatile mix of local funding. There's no guarantee that we have the funding available for state match. We understand that this will provide that stability, and that is important in planning for the future. We don't have stability. It's hard to add service if we have to take it away due to lack of stability and funding. I also envision this as a very equitable model for funding. We have good federal investment in the system. We have good local investment. We have rider investment. Where we're lacking is state investment. And really, I envision kind of a four-leg table in terms of transit funding, and this helps us get there. And we also recognize that expanded service is going to better meet the regional needs for intercommunity travel and for urban travel within Bend. So this is very important. I'll also note in closing that we, although we weren't able to get all the written testimony, we have support obviously from the city of Bend. OSU Cascades is a formal supporter of this. Commute Options and Economic Development for Central Oregon, our lead economic development entity, is supportive of this. So with that, thank you.
Thank you so much. And I will note, if you look on OLIS, there are a number of items in OLIS where written testimony has been submitted for everyone's perusal. So thank you so much. Can you tell me, what is the population of your regional system map? Are you under that? You are under that $200,000 mark, I'm assuming.
Chairman Yuen, thank you for the question. We are actually over 200,000 in total population when we look at the entire three-county area, including the tribes which we serve.
That doesn't put you into the...
Well, I didn't write that language. I'm not sure how that works, but it could be a reason for that sort of language. It would allow... we don't fit into any simple boxes, but yes, our population, to answer your question, is over 200,000 total.
Thank you. Mr. Gard.
Chair McEwen, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Hal Gard. I am the administrator of the Rail and Public Transit Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. In the interest of time, I did provide written testimony to the committee. I just want to make two quick points. Public transportation money comes into the state in a variety of ways. There are direct recipients. There's the state monies, either general fund or dedicated funds that come to ODOT for redistribution, as well as federal funds that come into redistribution. The money is in a variety of different pots. It has a variety of different obligations that go with it and a variety of different funding levels. So I just wanted to be really clear. ODOT redistributes 100% of all the money that comes into our program to all service providers. The issue I think that folks have been articulating is that not all recipients are able to access all the money that's made available. So that's just a little point of clarification I wanted to get out. If this bill was to pass, it is a new program for us, which means we would need to stand it up. We would need to go through the rulemaking process. The bill currently does not have any funds allocated to it, so I would request that standing up the program be delayed until there's actual funding provided, because there's a scalability issue. If there's a lot of money provided, that's a lot more work for us, and that's going to have a larger staff time involved with it. Also, if we have to stand up the program and there's no money, we still have work and time and money that we need to expend to stand up the program.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your comments. Gentlemen, thank you for being here this afternoon. Thank you. Questions for this panel? All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Next, I'd like to quickly call up Peggy Lynch, John Charles, and Sandra Gangle.
Yes.
Thank you. And again, I apologize. We're going to have to condense this a little bit, or our palette discussion may be constrained as well. So thank you for making your comments as brief as possible.
Yes, thank you. Mm-hmm. Chair McEwen, Vice Chair Davis, and members of this commission, my name is Sandra Gangle, and I am honored today to be testifying on behalf of the League of Women Voters of Oregon. The League is a nonpartisan grassroots political organization that encourages informed and active participation in government. I will try to highlight some of the points that were not covered by the earlier speakers. But I want to point out that the League is concerned that Oregon transit providers have been able to purchase many clean fuel-burning buses in recent years, including the Salem-Keizer Transit District. They've used state and federal assistance to purchase those buses. But many of those new buses are not being used to full capacity because the providers lack sufficient funds for operations, namely drivers and technicians. Smaller communities in the Salem-Keizer system, which lacks a payroll tax, as you've heard earlier, are particularly strained in funding their operations. Why is it significant to local communities like Salem-Keizer to have efficient and effective transit service? Marion Polk League members conducted an extensive transit study in 2012 and found answers to that question. As Alan Pollack told you earlier, our capital city's transit system cannot provide service on Saturdays or evenings. Some routes have been eliminated or reduced, and others are operated less frequently in the past. As a result, the independence of many community members and their ability to access employment, shopping, and civic and social activities has been suffering. This is especially true for residents with disabilities and those who do not own or use cars. The story can be duplicated in other Oregon cities that have insufficient funding sources, especially for operations. And we would like to enter into the record a copy of the Salem-Keizer Transit Study after our presentation here. The League support for House Bill 4078 is based on the premise that an effective transit system supports employment, education, and commerce. We also believe that affordable transportation can help reduce costs of social services by improving access to jobs, training, medical social services, appointments, and even to the visiting the social services themselves. We realize that benefits will only be achieved under this measure if a source of revenue can be identified and directed to the new fund. But we believe that healthy public transportation can be an economic driver, building stronger communities and improving tax bases. And we hope that once this is in place, that there will be federal and state funds available to help to benefit the districts that need their work. Oregonians need a working public transit system, and we urge your support for House Bill 4078.
Thank you. Ms. Lynch?
Chair McCune, members of the committee, this is Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. I just am here to be supportive simply because it is important for you to understand how the League came about to do this kind of thing. The National League, the State League, and this particular local league did this extensive study, came up with positions to be able to tell you today how important this bill is, not only to the Salem-Keizer District, and by the way, the League did support the ballot measure that failed, but also we have 13 local leagues around the state who are interested. You're spending a lot of time talking about affordable housing issues this session. This is a nexus to that conversation. So we encourage you to work on this bill, and hopefully we can get a product. Thank you very much.
And you can leave that with staff. Thank
you.
Yes,
I will.
Mr. Charles, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Charles, president of Cascade Policy Institute, and I'm a lifelong transit user and written publications about transit. And I was trying to pay attention very carefully over the last hour, searching for the phrase passenger fares or user fees, and I don't think I heard either one of those. And those are the people who actually benefit from transit. And in my experience, as much as I like transit, it tends to be underpriced. And if you talk to people who run transit systems, they seem to think that their customers or potential customers are broke, helpless, or both. And that's simply not the case. And I'll give you one prime example. When I bought a house out in Sandy 21 years ago, the city was already trying to leave TriMet. I helped them do that. And then they finally did, and they set up a payroll tax to help subsidize it. And I was there on the first bus when we had our little Sandy area metro, and the service was far superior to TriMet. The smaller systems tend to be more cost-effective. But the service was free to me as a rider. And I was also asked to be on the advisory committee to the city. And I went to advisory committee meetings, and I said, well, I was paying two-something when I was a TriMet rider. Now you're running me to Gresham Express Run, a much better service, for free. It's not free. Someone's paying. We have a payroll tax. And I said, do you really think that your service is actually worthless? It's got to be worth more than a penny. And the response was, everyone else in the committee, they were opposed to it. The city was opposed to it. I said, well, it would just be a real hassle to collect the money. He said, wow, billions of people around the world sell services and collect fees, but we can't do that here in Sandy. So it went on for about 12 years, and finally, like last year, due to a financial crisis, they instituted a $1 fare for one-way service, which is still underpriced. I also take the service regularly from Wilsonville down here to the Capitol, run by Chariots and Smart of Wilsonville. They split the service. It's $3 one-way service. I've told them more than once, informally, you guys are giving it away. It's way underpriced. If you charge me more, I would pay more, and maybe I also get better service. People in that business, tend to think they're welfare providers. They don't think of it as a business. So I think when they refuse to charge properly, I'd say it's some combination of the service is underpriced, employees are overcompensated, there's a lack of consumer demand, or all of the above. And I just think if this bill goes forward, which I'm not opposed to it going forward, as it runs the competitive gauntlet to get from here to the governor's office, you might actually strengthen the bill if you put in that if there is money attached to it at some point, that those transit districts with a higher cost recovery ratio get to go to the head of the line. Because when I look at TriMet getting billions of dollars of public subsidies from non-riders and their cost recovery is about 24%, that is pathetic. And some other districts have 0% cost recovery. But if someone comes to me and says, look, we'd like a public subsidy, and our users are paying 80% of operations cost already, well, I'm a lot more impressed with that. So those districts that have higher fare box recovery ratios should get first preference for non-rider subsidies, and those who are practically giving it away, it seems to me, should get a lower level of non-rider subsidies.
Thanks.
Thank you, sir, for your comments. Any questions for this panel? All right. I think that exhausts our list for this afternoon for this topic. I am going to... let me close the hearing on 4078.
I think we can do all of them in very short order.
Committee, we have four bills that we need to work, and I'm trying to decide if we should go ahead and work those bills very quickly. I don't think they will take very long and then move into our palette discussion. Is that amenable to everyone?
Right.
I think we'll change the order a little bit. All right. I think the first thing I will do is open a work session on House Bill 4020. Mr. Brennan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 4020, we heard this on Monday. It replaces a requirement that management companies and state agencies under contract with the Oregon Growth Board invest specified amount in Oregon rulemaking authority for the board to require investment in Oregon. We had an amendment, the dash one, which adds an emergency clause with the dash one. There is a fiscal impact statement that I will distribute now to the committee. It's also up on OLIS. There is also no revenue impact to the measure, so we have all the paperwork we would need to move this bill. It would go straight to the floor, Madam Chair. This is the one that Representative Reed came and testified.
Yes, mm-hmm. It is. And I believe we need to move the dash one first. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I move the dash one amendments to House Bill 4020.
Vice Chair Davis moves the dash one amendment to House Bill 4020. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? The amendment is adopted. Vice Chair Davis.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 4020 to the floor as amended with a do pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Davis moves House Bill 4020 with a dash one amendment to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Benz?
He's excused.
Representative Pack?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative
McLean? Aye.
Vice Chair Forsythe?
Yes.
Vice Chair Davis?
Aye.
Chair McKeon?
Aye. The motion passes. I think if you are amenable, we would ask Representative Reed to carry this bill. Thank you. Paperwork. I will close the work session on House Bill 4020 and open a work session on House Bill 4039. Mr. Brennan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 4039 modifies the definition of a rural airport for the Through Defense program, and also repeals the requirement when the non-resident pilots register with the state of Oregon prior to piloting aircraft in the state. The measure has an emergency clause. It came to us with a subsequent referral to House Rural Communities, Land Use, and Water. We were approved by the Speaker's office to rescind that referral, so the motion script before you reflects that, Madam Chair.
Vice Chair Gorsuch.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 4039 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Rural Communities, Land Use, and Water be rescinded.
Vice Chair Gorsuch moves House Bill 4039 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Rural Communities, Land Use, and Water be rescinded. Is there any discussion? Yes, Representative McLean.
Mine is not a discussion. I did receive a letter, and the letter they wanted to have into the record for this particular issue. I am going to vote yes on this. But one of the first two times we heard this, we asked some questions about some bigger related issues on land use, on water, and on some relationships between rural airports and urban airports. And this is from Tony Holt, 7670 Southwest Village Green Circle, Wilsonville, Oregon, 97070. And from Ben Williams, 23013, Uri Lane, Northeast, Aurora, Oregon, 97002. I want to make sure that I put it into the record and that I note that they were disappointed that this was not going to go on to the other committee because they believe that it had issues and consequences that will not be discussed, but this will be in the record for future documentation and future information about these issues.
Okay, thank you. Clerk, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Bentz?
Excused.
Representative Hack?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative McLean?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gorsuch?
Yes.
Vice Chair Davis?
Yes.
Aye. And the motion carries. I will be closed. Let's see where we are. We are. Oh, do we have a carrier on this? Who would anyone like to volunteer to carry?
I'll do it.
Representative Gorsuch, thank you very much.
We should give it to Bentz. I mean, if he doesn't show up,
yeah, there you go. We'll give him another one. He can have the speed limit.
Yeah,
the motion carries. I will close the work session on House Bill 4039, and I will open a work session on House Bill 4047. Mr. Brennan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 4039. Is the speed limit bill, Madam Chair. It increases speed limits on a couple of highway segments that were not included in the bill that we passed during the 2015 session. There's no amendment, there's no fiscal, or there's no revenue impact. There is a minimal fiscal impact to the measure, but we have it ready to move if should the committee decide to do so.
Thank you. Vice Chair Davis.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 4047 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Davis moves House Bill 4047 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Bentz?
Excused again.
Representative Hack?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative McLean?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gorsuch?
Yes.
Vice Chair Davis?
Aye.
And Chairman Lively?
Aye. The motion passes, and we will assign this to Representative Bentz to carry in his absence.
Was this a Barreto or a Bentz bill?
It was Barreto and Bentz.
Yeah, it's okay. Both of them. All right.
Is that amenable to everyone?
Sure.
That's good.
All right, then I will close the work session on House Bill 4047. And, Mr. Brennan, I believe we will move House Bill 4048 to the Monday calendar. Do we need to take any action to do that? All right, then we will be moving House Bill 4048 to our Monday calendar. And now we will return back to our public hearing on House Bill 4089. And I would like to call up first, she's here. Representative Parrish, welcome to our committee.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And is there anyone else you'd like to bring
welcome
up with
back.
You?
Yes, welcome back.
That's right.
I do have two guests, and I'll have them come on up.
Please
Adam
do.
Guests from IKEA. Yeah, welcome.
Okay.
And that's not for me, so I'll that. Okay. Well, good afternoon, Chair McEwen, members of the committee. For the record, Julie Parrish, House District 37, Westland and Tualatin, bringing you House Bill 4089, which is a bill around public procurement. And I want to talk a little bit about how I settled on this as one of my two priority bills for this session. In another universe, I used to do public school lunch procurement. We received in a lot of trucks on a lot of pallets with school lunch workers, some of whom were as much as 40 years older than me, having to handle the weight of the freight. And we would have workers' comp injuries. We would have, spoilage of material, just because sometimes if you've got folks who aren't turning the freight quickly enough and things sit out, you can't serve those to children. And so... So it came to my attention from a constituent, actually, who said, hey, there's this initiative around using corrugated pallets. Now, we have a lot of conversations in this building, and sometimes they're not always friendly conversations around what we as a state can do to work on environmental issues. My personal philosophy is I am not in the camp that is in the climate denier camp. I actually do, have real concerns about how we have... preserve our state for future generations. My kids are the eighth generation of my family to live in Oregon, so sustainability does matter to me, except I would like it to be market proven. I would like it to not cost taxpayers money. I would not like to see green energy type boondoggles, things like the Betsy credits and things that have wasted a lot of taxpayer dollars. I also want things that maybe some of my colleagues who are potentially skeptical or constituents were skeptical, to give them another reason why, if the outcome is save the planet, but we also are saving taxpayer dollars, can you get around that? And I think in 4089 that that's what you see. And so basically what the bill asks is that we start to take a 360-degree look at our procurement. Right now, when we put out bids, as I understand it from talking with DAS, that we put out bids sort of based on cost. This is how much it costs to bring toilet paper into the prison system, for example. And we may or may not be factoring, and I'm still trying to get to the bottom of, do we factor in things like fuel surcharge costs and other costs to dispose of pallets or to dispose of the waste side that comes with the shipping? Are we factoring in the environment? Are we factoring in a tax factor when we, you know, buy from a local company and that money comes back into the income tax stream? What's a local tax factor look like in procurement? And I've been having these conversations on procurement for a while, but this one is one that, given all the other environmental conversations we're having, is something that now has 31 members of our House sponsored onto, because it is something that I believe is proven in the marketplace. So, and I have brought a guest from a company who is doing this in the marketplace. So I want to let her tell her story, because I think, you know, what she's going to tell you, it should be intriguing to all of us. But I want to address the rest of my testimony and focus on the issues that I've heard that you might hear from people who are going to come up behind me. And I want to just address them now, preemptively. And so I'm just going to run down the list. And first I want to say, wood is sustainable. You will never hear me argue about trying to get to better forest logging on ours, you know, on our state forest and using our wood products better. And so I believe wood is sustainable. What is not sustainable in the freight after it leaves our wonderful loggers and becomes something else is the subsequent movement. So for every one pallet that has freight on it, it turns at least three times empty. That's the problem I am trying to address, is the reduction of truck traffic on the road. So part of being a 360-degree procurer as a state with large purchasing power, it is things like truck lightening up trucks on the road, truck traffic that creates wear and tear, seasonal weather damage to our roads. All of that we should start thinking about in our procurement, because ultimately we do pick winners and losers in procurement, and I'll explain that in a minute. But ultimately, the winner I'm trying to pick is the taxpayer. Get to our bottom line. So I want to talk about the food safety issues that you might hear. You will see in a document that I think Bob Russell explained a little better, testimony from a company called McCracken Motor Freight. They actually used to be my purveyor of freight. They used to be the largest commodity food distributor from the Department of Education. They had that contract for like 40 years up until recently, and it went to a California company. So company we'd done business with for 40 years for a few percent increase, that's that 360-degree piece of procurement I'm talking about. But I consider them an expert in public freight distribution, because they've served all of our school districts at one point or another. And so they have, in their testimony, they're going to talk about things like pest control with wood after it's been through multiple different places, because a pallet that's moving through the food safety or food channel might not have started in the food channel. It might have come from somewhere else. So I think you'll see that Mike from McCracken Motor Freight will address that. You're going to hear about safety and racking and moving freight. And I did get on the phone with DOC, and we talked about their racking. And racking is where you'll see in the pictures that I took that show some interesting pictures of racking. That is where you land your freight on a rack, like when you walk through Costco. And there are ways to address racking safety. There's a lot of data out there about how durable a corrugated pallet is on a rack. And last year in our statewide, we've only had seven cardboard workers' comp claims in the state. So you will talk about, hear some debate about that. But I do want to say, compared to seven cardboard injuries statewide, not just in our public, but across all employers in Oregon, nearly 300 pallet injuries in 2014. Now, I want you to remember, we went to that little session last night where they talked about getting our employees better chairs, because the average workers' comp claim is $15,000. Her number was wrong. It's actually about $18,000 for a state employee. State and public employees across all of the workers' comp claims in the state in 2014 represented $46 million. So if we can do things to reduce freight injuries, back injuries, the biggest workers' comp claim being back and repetitive motion injuries and lifting injuries, but 300 system-wide, public and private employers, pallet injuries, then that's worth a conversation in our procurement. You will hear that there's a negligible impact in the you know, to carbon and the environment, but I would argue that 780 less pallet pounds per truck because of the difference in the weight of a cardboard pallet versus a wood pallet is not negligible over multiple trucks. And in fact, I will give you my notes at some point. I'll make copies of this because we just got this from the DOC. But just for an example, in terms of that pallet turning that I talked about, the state of Oregon brings in $1 million of toilet paper a year, one line item. That's 30-plus thousand cases. And when you break that down into the number of pallets and the number of trucks, and then if you hear what our friends from IKEA are going to tell us today about how they have increased freight on a truck because of getting rid of their wood pallets in their system, a 20% freight increase on a truck would reduce 9.2 trucks off the road in Oregon from one line item in our budget. And then when you factor in the empties, we're really talking about 18.9 reduced trucks from one line item in our budget. So Mike has great data in her testimony about just how much a gallon of gas saves, carbon emissions. Like, that's not necessarily my expertise, but one line item, toilet paper. So I wanted to address that because you're going to hear that the cost savings is negligible. I was really intrigued by some written testimony you have from ODOT, and their concerns were this might be too hard, and this might cost us more money, and we're going to have to go back to our suppliers, and they're going to have to tell us that this is not necessarily easy for us to do. And you can read all of that yourself, starting with the discussion point in the testimony, and you'll see that in there. And I find that intriguing because as we look at things that we're asking the private sector to do, low carbon fuel, we're asking them to do clean coal, we're asking them to look at cap and trade, and they come and make those same arguments, we still may or may not pass legislation that has those kinds of impacts, but the state is representing that that is too hard for us to do. And so I find that sort of ironic, and I wanted to point that out to you as you look at what their concerns are. And then you're going to hear this last piece about, you know, sort of free market issues. I am a free market person. I am a fiscal conservative. And I feel like my shareholders in my company running the state of Oregon are my constituents and the taxpayers. So my first fiduciary responsibility to my shareholders is give them the best bang for their buck. So on the free market issues, I want to just explain to you that school lunch procurement, a different part of our public procurement, is doing time, place, and manner bidding all day, every day. So think about a school truck, a food truck, coming into your local residential neighborhood. We dictate the time. We say, you can't come in the morning because you'll wake up our neighbors. We give them a time window that they then have to, in the rest of their trucking day, meet our time window. And if we can put all kinds of other, you know, you have to come in a HACCP certified truck and you have to do all kinds of things for us to have serve safe food to kids. Time, place, and manner distribution. It's already happening in public procurement, but DAS doesn't do that. We just say that the toilet paper costs $10, and that's low cost bid. And we're not factoring in sort of that time, place, manner, but it exists in public procurement. So if I put out a bid for milk, cute little cartons, chocolate, white, and strawberry, 1%, 2% fat free, and I want it delivered in the time, place, and manner that meets the bid, and you respond, Alpenrose or Umpqua, I am ultimately going to pick a brand. And I might say that I want that bottle to come in a plastic bottle for our recycling, or I want it to come in a corrugated, you know, milk carton. And whoever responds with the low-cost bid, we already do this. So I feel it's not a winners and losers situation. We're doing this all over our public procurement everywhere else except at DAS. I think it's time for a real conversation about how we bring in our freight, find market-proven solutions to address the environment, reduce our costs overall on this issue, plus bigger globally for other issues in 17. The bill does have an exemption for, because you're here, you know, they don't hold water, you know, they're going to not, you know, stand out in the rain. You can water coat them, water seal them, and they are, again, the bill talks about what the manufacturer specifies they could or couldn't be used, but if you're talking about construction equipment out in the rain, this bill doesn't say you can't use a wood pallet. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to the folks from IKEA. I want you to hear their story because they were generous enough to, very last notice, give me a tour on Sunday, and then their corporate from, you know, across the globe said, hey, we want you, we're so excited about what we're doing and how we're saving money and the results to our bottom line. I just also want you to understand we have another debate going on right now about minimum wage. And after IKEA has put this into place, they've given two minimum wage increases to their people. They're now averaging $15.52 an hour, and they're using part of that to pay for that is the savings that they're realizing being better systems thinkers, and I think it's time for the state to do the same thing. So with that, I'm going to pass the mic.
Thank you, Representative. Welcome to our committee. Thank you for being here this afternoon.
Thank you, committee. My name is Alexini, and I'm the store manager at IKEA Portland. I've been with IKEA for 15 years, and I'm pleased to be here and share my store experience with the change from wooden to paper pallet. I've actually gone through this change twice, once in 2009 when I was still store manager in Rome, and once in 2012 here in Portland immediately after my move to the U.S. This change had a rough start from the store point of view because we are the last ring of a long chain. At the very beginning, we started to receive paper pallet, but still haven't implemented the new racking in the warehouse. So we had to repalletize every pallet, and that was the biggest challenge for us. As soon as we implemented the new racking, the acceptance of the change became exponential due to an incredible gain in efficiency in every step of our daily operations. Our day starts from receiving the goods, and here we have had the first gain in efficiency. More freight come to us packed on a truck than before. 45 wood pallet versus up to 66 cardboard pallet. Just to give you an idea, our volume increase in cubic meter for the last 4 years has been around 45%, but we receive about the same number of trucks. Because we receive close to 90% of our freight on paper pallet, we no longer need to stock the empty pallet to return to the distribution center in our dock. As a consequence, we have gained space that allow us to unload trucks faster, which means the truck can get back to on the road quicker. The replenishment of the store is much more efficient due to three main reasons. The paper pallet can be loaded on a pallet jack from both sides. So a coworker rarely need to change the pallet jack with different sizes of the pallet. Three times the amount of empty paper pallet can be stocked on a pallet jack, so less trips to the baler for the coworker. The trips is to the baler, and it just required the time to put the cardboard in the baler, not the time to make room in and stock the wooden pallet in the dock. When we open the store, it's much easier to maintain the commerciality and safety of the sales floor because we can keep reducing the size of the cardboard pallet as the merchandise sells, recycling as we go. Because of the space gained in the dock, in the rare cases in which we don't completely finish the replenishment in the morning, we can temporarily leave the received good in the area in which we used to stock the wooden pallet. This allows the coworker to get this product easily for the customer that eventually may need them. In the evening, the cleaning and preparation of the sales floor is much faster because of the same reason I mentioned for the replenishment. All this gain efficiency not only has contributed to the increased store profitability, but it has also contributed to a significant development in our sales thanks to the higher volume that we are receiving with the same number of trucks. Plus, paper pallets are really light, so you can lift a pallet with two fingers. This not only open up job opportunities to a more diverse and gender-balanced workforce in logistics, but help to significantly reduce the back injuries in our store. We have had a big training investment for achieving this reduction, and I cannot say that the paper pallets are the only reason for this reduction, but I can for sure say that injuries coming from twisting the back are the ones that have dropped the most, about 50% in these 4 years, versus about 30% of total injuries decrease that we have had. As we collect the cardboard, our waste management generates income most of the month. We still have a few suppliers that haven't switched from wooden to paper pallet, and sometimes we still use wood between the port terminal and the store. Nevertheless, while we used to send back to our distribution center empty wooden pallets once a week, we now only send one back every other month. Effectively, we have taken 42 semi-trucks a year off the road just in running empty pallets. That's how much Portland as a store has contributed to the 75,000 less tons of CO2 emission per year that IKEA has been able to achieve on global level. Yesterday, we had our monthly store rally with our coworker, and I shared with them that I was coming here today. So I asked them, what should I say if they ask me how you feel about the change? And they said, well, tell them that we would never go back to the wooden pallet and that we are proud of working at IKEA because of this change. Also, our suppliers are really glad that they don't have to deal with the pallets coming back to them and the cost associated with that.
Thank you so much for taking the time to come down here today. This is just fascinating.
Great.
You're up next, sir. Thank you for being here.
I guess I am. Thank you for having me, and thank you, Chairwoman, to the committee for hearing this important issue. My name is Adam Penner. I'm executive director of a global nonprofit that's located here in Oregon called Change the Pallet, and we are a very proud, knowledgeable partner of the World Bank's Connect for Climate program. And I've submitted a recent article they have on the front page of their document. Also for the record, I've submitted extensive testimony, and I believe one of our colleagues and friends in Washington, D.C., Mr. Roger Ballantyne, who served as climate change czar to President Clinton, also submitted a letter on behalf of this, in support on behalf of this legislation.
And we do have that letter.
Good. 10 years from now, most U.S. agencies, universities, hospitals, and other public entities will require deliveries from vendors to be on corrugated cardboard pallets. After all, wood pallets are a liability to the end recipient, and the additional costs of the highly inefficient national product transport system flow to public entities and we taxpayers that fund them. In the case of wood pallets, these include more trucks than necessary to deliver product, paying to have wood pallets removed versus receiving money for recycling cardboard pallets, extra trucks on the road that require highway repairs paid for by taxpayers and cause additional traffic and congestion. More trucks also equal more fuel and thus more carbon emissions. Worker injuries from handling heavy wood pallets are also included. All of the savings and efficiencies, as we just heard, have been proven by IKEA, which in 2012 began requiring 1,000 suppliers in 50 countries around the world to ship on corrugated pallets. The results have been astonishing. More than $1 billion in system-wide savings and more than 300,000 metric tons of CO2 emissions saved, as reported by IKEA. If IKEA can make this happen with 1,000 suppliers around the world, it's more than reasonable to expect that Oregon, ODOT, and its suppliers can do so too. If you like to think bigger, as we Oregonians like to do, what if the state's leadership triggers Nike, Oregon State University, or OHSU to follow suit? Then how many trucks are we going to take off the road, and how many emissions are we going to cut? However, even if nobody ever follows the Oregon procurement model that this bill will establish, isn't it worth passing if only one state worker in one state agency doesn't suffer an injury from having to handle heavy and dangerous wood pallets? I thank the committee for hearing Representative Parrish's visionary bill that, when passed, will have tremendous positive implications for the state and provide a global model for all public entities.
Chairman McEwen, I just want to point out a couple things that came with my testimony. Recently, a mill closure in the metro area has increased some of the wood headed for landfills. So this is currently a problem. Metro has this on their website, so it's not just, you know, something that I'm... But there are three articles there that I want you to read about what it means to not have places to put wood into the recycling. There are companies that do it, but they're kind of they're dispersed. They're particularly in the metro area. We don't have a lot of places to do this. And so I believe, as I understand it from the metro article, is that they're now accepting wood tonnage back into the landfill. North Carolina is the first state in the nation to actually ban wood pallets entirely from their landfills. They said you absolutely cannot, you can't do those. So that is currently a real problem that is happening right now up in our community. The other thing I want you to understand, this is about the state's procurement. I love this idea. I hope Nike and everybody else wants to do it. You will never see me vote to mandate it on them. Now, I'll work to incentivize it, but I'm not going to tell them to do it. This is about our own procurement and how we want to use our tax dollars to give the best possible outcome to the taxpayer. So I want to be really clear. This is not a stepping stone bill to a mandate for everybody else in the marketplace. I will work to incentivize them. If we prove it, we can go back with our numbers and say, hey, this really does work. What IKEA is doing is working. We're doing it as a state. Rest of our industry in Oregon, we would love to have each of you take 10 extra trucks off the road, and here's how we're going to help you get there. If you choose to do it, you will never see me come back around and mandate this for private sector. So, but I do think with our state dollar, we have an obligation. And I know Alex has, I think, one more thing. Are you going to add anything else?
Well, definitely, I can probably summarize my learning after experiencing the change twice in two different countries. And I would say that definitely the quality of the paper pallet and loading ledge is crucial for this change. For us, a close cooperation with our suppliers as well with our distribution center has been crucial to secure the success of the entire changeover. And I would definitely suggest to invest time in creating awareness of the change in the coworkers and in all the stakeholders before the change takes place. Taking good care of explaining why you're doing the change and anchor the change to the sustainability commitment, not only to the money saving. That has been a key point for us with our coworker too. Have this pride of making the change together with the rest of the company. I would also really highly suggest to underline that it is a long-term investment. There is racking that need to be changed. There is equipment that need to be adjusted. But make crystal clear that, like in every change, the expectation at the very beginning is to have a productivity dip. So if this come as a surprise, that's not good. I mean, we really need to, for this change, people really need to be prepared to that and to accept that at the very beginning there is an extra work to adjust, but then in the really short term, I'm really talking about 1 to 3 months, you really start to see the benefit of working in this way. And every coworker starts to realize how much more efficient they can be in doing the daily job. And again, I'm talking about the store experience that I have lived. I'm not talking about big numbers that IKEA can definitely provide. I'm really talking about the Portland store, the one that you can come and buy whenever you like.
Can I make one more point?
You may, and then we're going to need to move on. We've got about 5 minutes to hear about 9 more people. So.
I just wanted to note that I am familiar with the IKEA changes and investment that they made to implement their system globally. However, I have yet to see a corrugated pallet implementation system in the United States require retrofitting any forklifts or any other equipment. I think that was specific to IKEA's system. And what I've seen in the United States is available is that pallet jacks and forklifts fit most corrugated pallets into. Alex's point, they're also four-way pallets, which tends to create additional efficiencies. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are any you. Questions for this panel?
All right,
thank you. All right, thank you. I've lost my list, Mr. Brennan, in my stack. There we go. We are shuffling papers. Excuse me for one moment. I would like to call up next, and I will. I do have someone who is calling in. Why don't we go ahead and do that, Mr. Brennan? We have. And then in the on deck, as soon as we finish this phone call, if you'd like to come up and be seated, please. Let's do Bob Russell, Tom Wolfe, and Clyde Wolfe, please.
Hello, Patrick. This is Patrick Brennan here in Oregon at the Oregon State Legislature's House Transportation Economic Development Committee. You're on the phone live in the committee to talk about House Bill 4089, corrugated cardboard pallets.
Can you hear me?
Absolutely.
We can, sir. This is Representative McEwen. Please proceed with your testimony. You're here before a room full of about 30 people, and our committee is awaiting your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Chair McEwen, members of the committee, hello, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak with you today on House Bill 4089. Again, my name is Patrick Atagi, and I'm with the National Wooden Pallet and Container Association, the largest association of woodpacking professionals in the world. And I'm also an Oregonian. I grew up on a family farm between Neff and Adrian and Representative Benz's district, where potatoes and onions are the primary crops. So I'm pretty familiar with wooden containers from a hands-on perspective, as I built them for use with our onions. Chair McEwen, we recognize your record of working constructively with all sectors in promoting sustainability and the well-being of the Oregon economy. Like you, our members and their customers are committed to reducing environmental impact. I'm here today to testify in opposition to the measure in question. In the interest of time, I'll provide an overview of our already submitted comments. I believe HB 4089 risks unintended consequences for worker safety for Oregon businesses and does not achieve the important carbon goals outlined in the proposal. There is a company that would like you to believe that cardboard pallets are more environmentally friendly than wooden pallets because they're more lightweight. It's true that cardboard is lighter than wood, but the life cycle carbon footprint of a pallet is about a lot more than just weight. In fact, the carbon life cycle of packaging is actually quite complex. Manufacturing a cardboard pallet requires a lot more energy than manufacturing a wooden one. They're both made ultimately from wood, but for a cardboard pallet, wood has to be converted into cardboard through a manufacturing process that uses a lot of energy and chemical inputs. In contrast, wood pallets are basically organic. We're just talking wood and nails. In fact, the carbon emissions generated from producing a cardboard pallet can be 5 to 10 times greater than a comparable wooden pallet. In addition, under most real-world conditions, including exposure to the elements and repeated impacts by equipment like forklifts, wooden pallets last a lot longer than a cardboard one. That means you're going to end up manufacturing more cardboard pallets to ship the same volume of goods. And this just increases the carbon footprint of cardboard pallets further. Now let me turn to life safety. Safety is a critical issue when it comes to cardboard versus wooden pallets. Without getting too technical, wooden pallets are overall much stronger and stiffer than cardboard pallets. I mean, I'm betting you already knew this intuitively. We've all handled cardboard, and we've all handled wood. So why does this matter to safety? Because pallets are used in so many different ways. While cardboard pallets may work in some specific cases, they won't work safely in many others. Through this bill, the state of Oregon could be influencing the use of cardboard pallets in applications they cannot handle. The corporate interest backing this bill likes to hold up IKEA as an example of someone who uses cardboard pallets. But IKEA has the luxury of indoor climate-controlled storage for their pallets, protecting them from the moisture that can quickly degrade a cardboard pallet. Most companies and most state government agencies don't have that luxury. And building capacity to store cardboard pallets in indoor climate-controlled warehouses has its own carbon footprint. The website backed by the company supporting this bill said that 92% of leading U.S. retailers actually do not allow the use of corrugated pallets. I think that should tell you something right there. Let me quickly touch on jobs. There are 34 pallet businesses in Oregon.
Sir, we do.
$138 million of business every year. After that, the 10 to 15% of Oregon softwood lumber production that is used to produce wooden pallets, and you quickly see how this bill would have significant negative impact on the Oregon economy. Carbon footprint of packaging is an important and complex issue, and I ask you to give this issue the appropriate amount of consideration and study it deserves. I also very much appreciate you giving me the opportunity to present the strong case for the environmental, safety, and economic benefits of wooden pallets. I'd be happy to answer the questions you might have, and this concludes my remarks.
Mr. Atagi, thank you for joining us. I'm looking to the panel to see if there are any questions. I don't believe there are. You're welcome to stay on the line if you would like. I'm going to move quickly to our next panel. We're very short on time and long on list, so thank you so much. Is there anybody in the room? We will be revisiting this issue on Monday. Are there people who have traveled here to speak to this issue that I would like to take advantage of while you're here? And if there are those of you who will be in the building Monday, and we'd be welcome. Thank you, Mr. Russell. I appreciate that. We will certainly be revisiting this, and I want to make sure that we take advantage of the folks who have come a distance. So if you'd like to come up, and you, sir, please begin.
Okay. Madam Chairman, my name is Clyde Wolf. I'm not representing anyone in particular here. I happen to run a pallet repair recycling company, and there's probably 75 other companies like mine in the state. So there is, you actually have a copy of my 30-second tour of pallets. The only piece I want to elaborate on today is an unintended consequence issue. Pallets are always selected by the manufacturer when the product is first laid down. And so in something like IKEA, where they are the controlling and the only source for, you know, user of that product, they can specify a unique pallet very quickly. When you come to something like the many, many warehouses in the state, they end up, if you specify that the particular pallet, the product is a very normal thing, the manufacturer will go ahead and continue to use whatever they're using today. And what will happen is the product will get removed from their pallet to your specified pallet at some point in the process, that whole lumping process. And so there's a lot of manual labor. And I just want you to keep that in mind when you're looking at this. You have some opportunities in the state where you are the source of the product, and this is as good of a possibility as any. You also have a lot of sources where you are not the original or the primary user of the product. And I'd hate to see us have to move all those products across to specify a state requirement. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wolf. I appreciate you taking the time to come today. Sir?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Dave Schweitzer, the Executive Vice President of the Western Pallet Association, and I am here to in opposition to 4089, as is the National Wooden Pallet and Container Association. Very quickly, we have here on the West 175 members. Over half of them manufacture new wooden pallets or recycle wooden pallets. The remainder of the members are suppliers of lumber for the pallets, nails, and machinery to repair and also to manufacture. The popularity of wood for pallets, and if I may read this short paragraph.
Very briefly, okay. Please. Yes.
Has remained high not only because it is environmentally sustainable and cost-effective, but it is also extremely strong and rigid. These properties provide excellent protection for the product while in transit and storage. Wood is also highly customizable, delivering endless opportunity for companies to transport their goods by the most efficient means possible. For all these reasons, the free market continues to predominantly choose wood for its transportation needs. I would ask you, I think we're, I don't, I won't think anything. I would ask you before moving forward on this bill to study it for the environmental claims that have been made, for the risk to life safety, and to the economical or economic consequences. And we, the Western Pallet Association, and the National Wood Pallet and Container Association would be more than happy to help in your research. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for your testimony this afternoon. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair McEwen and committee members. For the record, my name is Mike Sullivan. I am the Oregon political director for the Association of Western Pulp and Paper Workers, and we applaud this effort. What Representative Parrish was talking about earlier is Metro no longer accepts engineered or treated wood. It would have normally been to a plant that we represent in Newburgh, West Rock. And the last year, with 127,000 tons was used in their cogen plant that relatively burns very clean, that is now going to the landfill. And the rate that is going to the landfill now is $94.98 a ton. Normally, it would be $51, $56 a ton. So this is a win-win for us because of the shutdown. We have lost 260 members. Normally, I feel like a Judas goat because I've been doing this job since 2005, and the numbers go down. This mill could be converted over to do cardboard. So it would be twofold for the state. It would take the scrap wood and make it clean energy to produce the cardboard to make these pallets. It's time that we did something for the environment that also helped the industrial base in the state. We are losing these jobs, and the production of paper worldwide is going off the Richter scale. And the carbon print, because it's overseas and not produced here, is getting worse. So in conclusion, I don't see why this can't be done. I don't see why there can't be cardboard, pallets, and wood as well. Okay. And I thank you, and I'd answer any questions that I could.
Thank you, sir. Questions for this panel? All right. Thank you, gentlemen, for being here. We appreciate it very, very much. I have one, two, three more, and if we could get them done in 6 minutes, I'll just be a happy camper. Mr. Freres, Heath Curtis, Paul Cosgrove, let's call up that panel. Tom, I think I see you came back in. You were gone when I called you. So are you going to be back in the building on Monday?
I'll be here.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us today.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. My name is Robert Ferris, Jr. I'm Executive Vice President of Ferris Lumber Company. It's located 30 miles east of here in Lyons, Oregon. We manufacture wood products and byproducts that are used for paper and cardboard and employ 480 people. Our lumber is heat-treated for shipment overseas as crating and pallet stock. This is necessary to avoid invasive species from entering countries around the globe. Our plywood products are used for crating, packaging, and pallets also. Plywood's lost 90% of its residential market share to a cheaper substitute known as oriented strand board in recent years. But plywood's characteristics lend its use heavily into industrial, commercial, and agricultural markets. This bill today is a real market disruptor at a time when the U.S. manufacturing index has hit its lowest point since 2009. So I think we're headed toward a recession. In 2007, we began operation of a wood-fired cogeneration facility producing steam for our plant processes and a renewable energy to power 7,000 homes on the grid. We purchase recycled ground-up pallet stock is clean boiler fuel for this plant, and this bill today would jeopardize the continued operation of the cogen plant if fewer wooden pallets are recycled and eventually used as fuel. There's an appropriate place for corrugated and wood packaging. House Bill 4089 creates many questions and uncertain consequences, and I feel this 35-day legislative session is just too short to vet this bill, and we ask that it just be set aside until it receives proper scrutiny. And thank you for the opportunity to.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for your testimony.
Chair McEwen, members of the committee, my name is Heath Curtis. I'm the Oregon Forest Industries Council, and we're here opposing House Bill 4089. I wanted to apologize. Ordinarily, when we show up here, we have formally approached each of you and expressed our intentions. This bill came on quick. We found out about it this weekend when we discovered a glitzy website and a video that a company put together advocating for cardboard pallets. It took us a little while to poll our membership and figure out impact. As it turns out, the majority of the economy and utility number three, 2x4s and 2x6 produced by our members are actually fed into the wood pallet market. 10 to 15% of Oregon's softwood market is used for wood pallets. This is a pretty sizable market for Oregon forest landowners. We're also pretty skeptical of the environmental claims, and some folks have talked about that before. Without dwelling on the details, I'd also suggest that this is a pretty odd way for the state of Oregon to set climate policy. Any number of special interests could appear before this body asking the state of Oregon to choose their product given relative carbon emissions. In fact, I'm pretty sure we could make that very same argument here for wood pallets. However, if that's the path the legislature chooses to pursue, it threatens to pit friends against friends in mature markets at the expense of good policy in Oregon's economy. Seems there ought to be a better way to do this. In closing, we believe it would be unfortunate if the state of Oregon chose to abandon this market for Oregon forest products on dubious environmental claims made by outsiders immediately preceding a short session. And we respectfully urge you to vote against it.
Thank you. Mr. Cosgrove, welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Paul Cosgrove representing the American Forest and Paper Association. As you can tell from that name, we represent forest products. We represent paper, including cardboard manufacturers. And thus, we have members who make both of these products. And we both think both of them have environmental benefits and both of them have legitimate uses. And absent a compelling case, and we don't think one has been made for the superiority of one either in cost or performance in all occasions, there are some places where cardboard makes sense. There are lots of places where wood makes sense. We think it's inappropriate to have a state purchasing policy prefer one over the other. It makes sense for the manufacturers who are trying to deliver products to this state and their other customers to pick the best way they know to deliver that product, the safest, the way that protects the product, the best way to handle it. So we would urge you not to adopt this bill. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. Questions for this panel?
I just have a comment.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll keep it quick. I just want to say thank you for taking the time to come and testify. I originally had a different thought on this bill, so because of your testimony and because of folks knocking on my door, I have a completely different perspective than what was originally kind of given to me. And I think it is important to vet things, and I too am concerned with 35 days because there's obviously a whole lot more to this than what I had initially looked into. So at this point, I'm not going to be supportive. So I just wanted you to know that and to let you know that I appreciated you being here, because there's definitely more to learn about this.
And Representative Hack, that's why we have committee hearings.
Yes.
Where people come and testify.
Thankfully.
That's the crux of the whole system. But yeah. But I do appreciate all of you being here today.
I do too.
This is a brand new issue for me. I know very little about this. Mr. Furs, I have a question for you, though. I have an interest in cogen facilities. I sat on the Energy Trust Board for a number of years and worked on helping support some of those endeavors. And you're supporting 7,000 homes, so how many megawatts are you producing? It must be
10. We have a maximum of 10.
Great.
There are avoided cost rates, and there are scheduled price that is available for producers that make 10 or less. And so we have a 10 megawatt and 100,000 pound boiler.
So my question to you has to do with your comment about wood pallets being used for hog fuel. So does this create a problem for you because there would be a lack of supply and your costs would go up? Or would you not be able to find a supply chain for that hog fuel?
We purchase about 50 truckloads a week in addition to the fuel that we produce
on your own site.
On our own site.
Mm-hmm.
And The pallets, Oregon Pallet in Salem and in Portland, they remanufacture them and remanufacture them several times, and at some point
they're done,
and mm-hmm. so they grind them up and they bring them to our plant, and it's We want very clean fuel. It's dry fuel. It's some of the best that we can find, and we use a variety of urban wood and forest thinnings and that sort of thing for our fuel. But pallet stock is really good.
So would your cost go up?
Or is this just
this is what you prefer because of the nature of the because it's clean.
Well, it's clean and it's close by. It's in Salem, so there's a close
transport.
And Portland, we have chip trucks, so we take the wood chips up to the paper plants in Longview, and we come back through Portland and stop at these urban wood locations and bring back our fuel on a backhaul, and some of that is ground up pallet stock,
okay,
both in Portland and in
Thank you
here.
Very much. I appreciate that. I apologize. This is a very busy week for us, and some of us have had jobs they had to go to. We have some who are actually off-site doing other things that are legislative business that drew them away today. So I'm assuming that we will have a continued conversation about this, and then my colleagues will be able to answer and or ask questions that they might have in the future. So I'm sorry we didn't have a full contingent today. It's the nature of a 35-day session, and I hope you all understand that we're all doing our very best and very with very dense schedules at the moment.
Thank you so much
for being here. On that note, I will close the hearing on House Bill 4089, and unless there is anything else for the good of the order, I'm going to adjourn us just a modicum late. Thank you all for being here today.